Welcome to the Money and Marriage Podcast. I'm your host, Bill Nelson. My mission to empower millennial couples to make money moves that won't just improve your financial health, but strengthen your marriage as well. In this podcast, I share stories, tips, and tricks, both from my experience as a certified financial planner and from my own marriage, to help you and your spouse kick financial anxiety to the curb and use your money to create the lives you love together. Let's get started. All right, welcome to this week's episode of the Money and Marriage Podcast. I am back after a few weeks of not having a voice. It's been quite the start to the new year for me, but I am very happy to be back here today. And I wanted to talk a little bit about data and the way we use data and statistics in financial planning. Look, right, there's no way to get around this, right? Data and stats are the bedrock of any good financial plan, right? A financial plan without data is not worth very much. Frankly, that's the reason why I started doing this work in the first place. I'm a math nerd at heart. But you know, as the years have gone by and I've worked with more and more couples, I've seen time and time again that data, statistics, spreadsheets, right? They only get you so far, right? I think it can be easy to get bogged down with the data and the spreadsheets that you lose sight of the most important pieces of your financial plan, right? Or even you can use data to draw the wrong conclusions if you're not focusing on the right thing. And I see that a lot with the way that we talk about data, specifically about the intersection of money and marriage. You know, some of the ways that like people in the media and academics and financial planners will talk about money and marriage stats, frankly, is actually pretty good. You know, surveys and statistics, research that's put out can do a really good job of highlighting the really important issues that are out there and calls people's attention to some warning signs that can pop up before they actually become a problem for you. But, you know, I mean, we live in the TikTok world, right? Clickbait journalism, soundbite media, right? All these things where we take little snippets and focus on that rather than focus on the context, right? I see that as a problem a lot of times when it comes to how we apply marriage and money statistics or specifically statistics about money and marriage problems, right? I see people use statistics in misleading ways. I see people using statistics that, frankly, I'm not sure are actually backed by any sort of research. They just make up. Oftentimes, right, people share these data without highlighting those nuances, right, and draw general conclusions from them, right? These sorts of trends, right, I think can lead people down the wrong paths, right? It can lead couples to draw the wrong conclusions and make financial mistakes that they might not have otherwise, right? When obviously we don't want to make these problems worse in the process. So I wanted to talk through four of the most common financial questions I get from couples who are looking to get on the same financial page. And I want to talk about some of the statistics that are out there and some of the research that's out there that I see cited, right, as answers to these questions when I talk to people. Because often, like, I see couples come in and that they have drawn false or incomplete or conclusions that they were a little bit premature based on what they've heard, right? In my work as a certified financial planner, as in my work as a certified financial therapist, level one practitioner, right? My hope is that adding kind of some of my expertise to the data and the discussion that is out there might help you avoid some of those problems, right? That's my goal. I want to talk about four key areas. First and foremost, I want to talk about combining bank accounts, right? And some of the data that's out there for that. When I got started, right, doing this couples work, I started my firm back in 2016. I really kind of shifted into the money and marriage space in late 2017. You know, for those first few years, right, the couples who were looking for guidance on whether or not they should combine bank accounts was really models, right? When I was trying to figure out best practices back in the day when I was getting started, information was all over the place, right? You know, you can find quote unquote financial experts or money gurus out there who will tell you you always need to combine all of your accounts, 100% of your accounts after you get married, right? And you can find equally respected people who will tell you never to combine anything, which is not helpful. Which is why a study that came out last year from Indiana University caught my eye. All right. We actually talked about this when it came out in episode 96. If you're interested in this topic more, you can go back and listen to that full episode. The study by Indiana University studied hundreds of couples over a two-year period. The researchers told half of the couples that they had to combine all of their accounts, And they told the other half that they could not combine any of their accounts, right? There was no choice given to the people here, right? They either were part of the group that combined or part of the group that didn't combine. And at the end of the 2-year period, right, they did a bunch of surveys and looked at how the couples were doing. And the data was pretty conclusive, right? Couples who combined bank accounts had stronger marriages, fewer money fights, and better financial outcomes, more confidence in their financial situation than couples who didn't combine, which is striking, right? Like that's a pretty definitive conclusion, particularly because they actually found that this wasn't just like a coincidence. They proved it was causal, right? The act of combining accounts actually caused couples to be happier and more successful by the way that it made them manage money together. This drew a lot of publicity, right? Myself included. Like I said, I did a podcast episode that came to this similar conclusion that we're going to talk about in a second, right, when it came out. But I saw a lot of other planners at the time see this and say, okay, great, like consensus is answered, right? Couples should clearly combine all of their accounts, since doing so strengthens marriages and leads to financial outcomes. And at the time, if you go back to episode 96, I said that drawing that conclusion from this research is a little problematic because it ignores a really key component of the study. And that is that every single couple who participated in the study was willing to be told that they needed to combine accounts. And not only were they willing to be told it, but they were actually willing to do what they were told, right? Everybody who participated in the study was willing to be told they had to combine all their accounts or they couldn't combine anything. And in the real world, that's often not the case, right? If you try to compel somebody to combine accounts who has concerns about doing so, and you're not addressing those concerns, you're saying, too bad, like the study says we need to do it, so we need to do it. It's not a recipe for success unless we can address those underlying concerns first. You know, when I coach couples through this decision to combine or not combine accounts as part of my marriage-centered financial planning process, right, we always start by understanding the reasons why someone might not be interested or willing to combine accounts, right? What are the roadblocks to that, right? What's holding you back? That's the really important thing to identify as part of this, right? Because once we explore those reasons, right, we can either work through them and get to the point where people do combine everything, or we implement a more blended type account structure, right, for the couple based on their specific preferences in a way that isn't using separate accounts as a way to avoid tough money conversations, right? I should say, right, almost always, right, this is going to involve combining some accounts, right? You could keep everything separate, but I don't see the couples who are having the most success keep literally everything separate. But I see plenty of couples have success who have a more hybrid type approach. At the end of the day, it's more important, frankly, to address the underlying concerns behind this and to make sure you're working together financially than it is to combine your accounts or not combine your accounts. I'm happy to help you have this conversation if that's something you're interested in. You can reach out to me. At the end of the day, despite what that research study concluded, marriages aren't defined as successes or failures by whether your Bank of America account has one or two people's name on it, right? It just isn't. They're defined about how you communicate about tough and important topics like money. That's what you want to be focusing on here. So that's the first piece, combining bank accounts. The second area where I often see some interesting statistics cited to draw some conclusions with that I might not agree with has to do with debt, right? The impact that debt has on marriages. It's probably no surprise that debt is arguably like the most common source of financial stress and disunity within marriages. I've seen that in the hundreds of couples I've talked to over the years, and it's certainly true. And the data backs that up. Once again, back in 2023, last year, there was a survey put out by SunTrust Bank that found that, I raise my eyebrows every time I see this. I work with engaged and newlywed couples. This still surprises me. 3 in 5 Americans have considered postponing a marriage to avoid inheriting a partner's debt. Okay, reading it word for word. 3 in 5 Americans have considered postponing a marriage to avoid inheriting a partner's debt. And once you're married, the data is actually not that much better, right? The same survey found that 54% of couples believe that having a partner in debt could be a reason for divorce. I've seen couples in a lot of different financial situations, a lot of different configurations of debt, and I've seen those couples not get divorced as a result of it or put off marriages. I'm not surprised necessarily by the spirit of those statistics, a little bit by the magnitude, but not the sentiment. But frankly, I wish that survey had asked a few follow-up questions, right, to give the data a little bit more nuance, because I think that my suspicion is if we were to really probe some of these couples just based on the sampling I've seen over the years, the reasons why, right, couples might be looking to avoid or postpone marriage or potentially consider a divorce because of debt, typically it has to do with the attitudes the other person has about debt rather than the debt itself, right? Because that ultimately is the most important thing in terms of how it dictates your family's financial success in the future. You know, in my experience, engaging newlywed couples with debt, particularly when one spouse has most or all of it, there's a lot of emphasis put on whose name is the debt in, whose responsibility is it, who's making the payments, rather than the spirit of the person who has the debt, right? Are they looking to actually do something to fix it? And just thinking through the impact it's going to have on your lives and your future, right? You know, if your partner has a lot of debt and you don't, the easy answer in the short term is to just wash your hands of it, say, it's not my debt, it's not my problem, let them deal with it. But the problem is that if you are going to stay with this person, which if they're taking their debt seriously, I would argue you should, their debt's going to have an impact on you. You know, even if you're not the one whose name is on it, even if you're not the one who's making the payments, your quality of life as a family is going to be impacted by debt. And I think that, you know, focusing on whose name is it in and like postponing a marriage because of it, none of that changes the fact that like there's going to be an impact, right? Could be an impact in the short term, right? If your spouse is struggling with debt, right? But they might not be able to cover, quote unquote, their share of living expenses. They might not be able to go on vacation with you. Or it could be longer term, right? If your spouse struggles with debt for years and you're not willing to help them with it, it's likely to impact your retirement goals. If you're able to save for retirement really aggressively and they're struggling with their debt payments, like you're going to be retiring alone. There's no other way around it. Or you're going to be working to support them, working longer than you need to support them, rather like, and you might have been able to avoid that had you handled the debt a little bit differently, right? You know, if you have a happy, healthy relationship outside of the debt, right? Debt shouldn't be a deal breaker as long as your spouse is taking it seriously, right? As long as they hear your concerns and are willing to work with you on it. But thinking through like whose name is it in and stuff, like to me that misses the point here, right? The faster you can come to terms with the idea that your spouse's debt is going to impact you one way or the other, the easier it can be to find a solution for how to handle it that makes it easier to achieve your goals in the process. The statistics I cited, right, show that debt clearly does have a negative impact on marriages, but it doesn't have to, right? If you're able to get on the same page with handling debt and implement a plan together in a way that works for both of you, right, this is an obstacle that I see people work through all the time, and it is possible. The third statistics that I see that I think we need to think through how we interpret have to do with financial infidelity, right? We did a deep dive on this topic back in episode 76. It's actually one of the more popular episodes I've ever put out. If you want to go back and listen to that, I'd recommend it. This idea of financial infidelity, right? When we use the word infidelity normally, right? We're talking about someone who cheats on their partner, whether it's physical or emotional or whatever it might be. You know, financial infidelity doesn't literally involve cheating, but it does involve the secrecy that often accompanies this. You know, financial infidelity involves engaging in any sort of financial behavior that is expected to be disapproved of by your romantic partner and intentionally failing to disclose this behavior to them. The secrecy is really bad for marriages in the long run, right? Particularly if the issue isn't corrected. And unfortunately, the data shows that financial infidelity is more common than you might expect it to be. A study that I found when I was putting together my book, Marriage Centered Money, back in 2022, highlighted this, and I've always found this data point to be really, really interesting, right? The study conducted by researchers at the University of Southern Mississippi back in 2018, and was later published in the Journal of Financial Therapy, they found that 27% of people admitted to keeping a financial secret from their partner. And 27% of people admitted to keeping the secret, but 53% of people reported behaviors associated with financial infidelity. Fascinating to me, right? I see people cite these statistics all the time, right? Where 1 in 4 people about admit to keeping financial secrets, and 1 in 2 people report behaviors associated with financial infidelity. But I don't see people tie them together, because the thing that we miss if we don't tie those two together it's the denial behind that, right? To paraphrase those results, what survey respondents were given a list of acts of financial infidelity and asked if they'd ever done one or more of them, right? 53% of people said yes. But then when they were asked if they actually committed financial infidelity, only 27% of people said yes, right? Half the people who are engaging in acts of financial secrecy actually recognize and admit that it's a problem. And the other half are doing these things, but then when they're asked, are they keeping financial secrets, they say no, they're not, right? It's a really common problem. And part of the reason why, you know, I talk to people, they say, oh, like that's not applicable to us. And then they find out a while later that it is. It's like, oftentimes we just often don't recognize these behaviors as problems in the real time, but they can be down the road. Financial infidelity is a topic that's gotten a little bit more publicity over the past few years, which has been great, but I don't see enough people highlighting this disparity between the act, right? The acts of secrecy and admitting that it's actually a problem, right? It would be like if somebody was surveyed and asked if they've ever cheated on their partner and they said, well, no, I haven't done that, but I have had like a really flirty relationship with somebody at work for the past several years, right? That has been a little inappropriate at times, but I haven't cheated. Like, I mean, maybe, maybe not, right? But like that's the sort of thing that I see in the data here when we talk about financial infidelity. It doesn't help you to know that financial infidelity can lead to problems in your marriage if you don't know how to identify whether or not you're actually engaging in financial infidelity related behaviors, right? Frankly, my biggest advice, if you're kind of listening to this and wondering if this is applicable to you or what you should be looking for, what patterns can be challenges or problematic, it's the secrecy piece, right? That's the reason why I've used this word so much. You want to consider the degree to which secrecy plays a role here. If you're doing something, but it's not a secret, it's out in the open and everybody knows about it, it's probably not a big deal, right? But if you're intentionally hiding something, that's when it can be a problem. If you periodically go to the grocery store and like, or the convenience store and buy a lottery ticket every now and then, right? Or if you every now and then bet on a sports game, right? With DraftKings or whatever, I'm not in that world. I don't know the specific things, but you know, if you're doing something like that every now and then, and it's not an addictive type behavior, right? If everybody knows that it's going on, or you're willing to share that it's going on, like those things every now and then aren't necessarily a big deal, right? Or at least they're not a big deal on its own. But if you're intentionally hiding gambling from a partner, that's a different story, right? It's the secrecy behind it that you want to pay attention to more than anything. So anyway, that's financial infidelity. The last thing I want to talk about are money fights in general and the stress that they cause on marriages. Because I mean, it's true, right? There's no shortage of data points that suggest that money can be a toxic factor in marriages, right? Study in 2019 by TD, there was a study in 2019 by TD Ameritrade that found that 40% of millennial couples argue about money at least once a week, and 29% of divorced baby boomers, 41% of divorced Gen Xers ended their marriages due to, at least in part, due to financial disagreements. Money is the topic that caused them the most stress for couples, according to a survey by Ally Bank in 2018. Financial disagreements are the number one indicator of a future divorce, right? By a study from the Family Relationships Journal. There's all these studies that show that money fights are problems for marriages, right? And they're true, right? Money fights are common in marriages. They're pervasive and they're harmful for marriages. I'm not arguing with any of that data. But what I am arguing is the way that we talk about it, because it drives me crazy when we talk about this, that it's easy to look at those data points and just assume money is inevitably a bad thing for your marriage, right? Because the way that we talk about money issues in marriage, like money marriage problems, like it's always a problem. And that's just not true, right? The data doesn't lie. Money is a huge source of stress for couples. It is a big stress of arguments. It is a cause for disunion in marriages, but it doesn't have to be that way. I think it's easy to look at that research on how money impacts marriages and start drawing some false conclusions. You know, if money is something that couples fight about, so many couples fight about, like maybe it's best if we don't talk about it at all, or we keep things separate so we don't need to confront these things, right? It's easy to draw conclusions like that, but the opposite is true as well, right? This is the kind of key thesis of my book. It's the key theme of this podcast, right? Money can be a bad thing for your marriage if you don't work on it together. But if you can learn how to get on the same financial page, if you can learn how to manage money effectively with your partner, you're not just going to have better financial outcomes, although you probably will have some better financial outcomes. You're going to strengthen your marriage as well. And again, I wrote a whole book on the topic, Marriage Centered Money. You can get that at marriagecenteredmoney.com if you're interested in learning more. At the end of the day, regardless of all of these subjects that we're talking about here today, right, from debt to combining accounts to money fights to financial infidelity, right, money can either weaken or strengthen your relationship, but you get to choose which. Every couple has their own unique money histories, money perspectives, money attitudes, money values. Data and research about like best practices in the field of money and marriage, frankly, they're not, like, there's not much focus that's been placed on them, but the ones that, like, the data that's out there can provide a helpful perspective to help guide your financial decision making as a couple, but it's important to apply these data points in the correct context as well. Right. That's what we want to do here. We want to implement a game plan for your family that both considers these data points, these research points, and specifically tailors them to your family's situation, right? Yeah, like we don't need to look at a survey that says that 3 in 5 couples do this or 40% of couples do that and automatically think that it applies to you, right? But we also shouldn't look at it and think it automatically doesn't apply to you, right? We want to take the information that's out there and synthesize it into a plan for your family that works for you. And if we can do that, if we can tailor those best practices to your family situation, you're going to be much, much more likely to use your money to create the lives you love. Hope you enjoyed this episode. Hope it gets you thinking. It's a little bit longer, I think, than some of the episodes we've done in the past, which is exciting. Let me know what you think. Thanks so much. Thanks so much for tuning in to this episode of the Money and Marriage Podcast. If you want to learn more, you can access my favorite money exercise for free if you head to paysetterplanning.com/moneyandmarriage. Again, that's paysetterplanning.com/moneyandmarriage. Get your access today, and I'll see you next time.